8 at home tonight against Ottawa. And in college basketball, the number 20-ranked UW Badgers host Illinois tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, 18th of February. Still a chance of some more snow showers this morning, a high of 26. Cloudy and very cold tonight, a low of 8 above. And then Tuesday, partly sunny and seasonal, tomorrow's high 29. So here are the numbers now. First of all, on the radar, the current snow system is now off over the lake. It is 22 degrees in Racine, 21 in Kenosha, 19 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the northwest at 10, wind chill 9 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. Work as a licensed professional counselor or mental health and awareness advocate. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
On it, you know, 20 or 30.
We have just passed the milestone of the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, which saw the fall of the Shah and the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and life changed drastically for the people of Iran during those tumultuous events. And those of us in the West, of course, do not begin to really fully understand the ramifications of what it means to have one's country so utterly changed, seemingly in an instant. On top of it, we tend to not fully appreciate what such wrenching changes mean in the lives of ordinary people, and in particular, in the lives of innocent children. That's what makes the book we're going to talk about for the next few minutes so important. The book is called Taking Cover: One Girl's Story of Growing Up During the Iranian Revolution. The author, Niusha Homayunfar, was a young teenager at the time of the Iranian Revolution. And her lovely book, published by National Geographic, talks about her, first of all, experiencing a displacement when her family moved actually from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Iran, and what that was like for her as a youngster. She grew to love Iran, and then Iran changed drastically, radically, and in almost every single respect, changed for the worse, especially as far as her own life was concerned and the life of her family. Fortunately, she survived these events, and of course, not everybody was so fortunate. She has written a really intriguing memoir about her experiences, and I'm very, very excited that we can speak with her. She now makes her home in Washington, D.C. with her husband and children, and this book, again, from the National Geographic Society is called Taking Cover: One Girl's Story of Growing Up During the Iranian Revolution. Niusha Homayunfar, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having me.
Very, very excited about this. I think it would be helpful if we first had you sort of sketch the rough outline of your family's background before they found their way to Iran, which was at some point during your own childhood. Just explain a little bit about where you were and where your family had lived before they resettled to Iran and what brought them there.
Absolutely. In the 50s, 60s, Iranians who could afford it loved to travel to the West to get a Western education. And my father was one of those young men. He had moved from Iran to Belgium to seek an education. He had followed some of his friends. And my mother has moved from France to Belgium also to attend university there. And that's where they met. and they got married, and that's where I was born in 1970. Well, from Brussels, then they decided to move to the U.S. because, you know, obviously getting an American education was quite popular. So my dad wanted to get a degree here, and so we moved to Pittsburgh. And in 1976, my father decided to answer the calls of his family asking for his return back home, and he moved us to Iran. And my mother was actually thrilled to move there as well because she had visited Iran once and loved the culture. She loved the people and everything about it. She was really looking forward to building a home there. And in those years, life in Iran was quite nice. There were many foreign companies that had started businesses in Iran. The economy was doing really well. And so people who had these Western educations, like my father and my mother, and extra languages like French and English, were able to find really good jobs. And that's what happened in 1976 when we moved there. I started a French-Iranian school. And I learned Farsi, albeit begrudgingly, because I was really upset that we had moved from the U.S. to Iran because I didn't know anybody in Iran. But I grew to love the country, as you mentioned, and I fell in love with my dad's family and the culture and the food. And then a few short years later, in 1979, the Shah of Iran, who was the king then, was ousted and was replaced by a religious cleric named Ayatollah Khomeini. And the changes were just so drastic because we went from living in a country where women, if they wanted to, could wear mini skirts. I also have to mention that there were still very religious people, but they practiced for themselves, and it was a personal decision that wasn't being imposed on anybody. So women could come out to dress however they wanted to, and then within a few months, we had to cover ourselves up and wear a robe covering our whole body. Only our hands could be seen from the wrist down, and the oval of our face, our heads, had to be covered. So as you can imagine, it was just really a lot to take. And shortly after that, in 1980, we suddenly found ourselves at war with our neighbor, Iraq. So we had now a war to contend with, as well as a religious regime. So it was many changes that kind of happened, some of them overnight, and then some of them were more gradual to allow time for people to digest it all. But it's been really quite the dramatic change. And 40 years later, the revolution is still alive, which is astonishing to me.
Right. One of many valuable things about your book is that you really help us appreciate, although I guess you don't dwell on this a whole lot, but you really do help us understand what Iran was like before the revolution. In the foreword, which is actually, I think, by somebody else, they say the Iran that we knew was a country with a cosmopolitan capital where women tried to emulate the latest European fashions, where the population was mostly secular and where Jews, Christians, and Muslims coexisted peacefully, women making advancements in many fields and on and on. And even through a child's perspective, you grew to really love Iran and loved many things about it that with the revolution would be wrenched away.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The foreword was written by another Iranian-American author named Firuzeh Duma, and she really did a good job of highlighting that. In those years before the revolution, people who could afford it traveled to Europe all the time. I remember some of my relatives would actually travel to London and Paris with empty suitcases so they could just fill them up with all of their shopping and bring their goods back home. And the shops in Paris and London would spot an Iranian shopper miles away because they were very generous with their spending and would come and buy multiple things from their stores. So Iranians were known for being able to, their money really carried a lot of weight back then. And it became such a nice place where you had sort of very traditional cultures mixed in with more Western cultures and traditions. And people were very open to changes. And the Shah was really doing a lot to modernize the country. He was building a lot of hospitals and railroads and schools and universities. And there were many Western schools. So mine, for example, was a French-Iranian school, but there was also an American school and a British school. And so people were just really enjoying all of these changes. But I'm saying all this obviously knowing that that changed because the country still was a traditional and religious country. And the people who were really religious-minded had a very hard time dealing with the Shah's outlook toward the West and his reception of the West and his relationship with the U.S. and England. And eventually that's what brought on really the demise of his reign and put the Ayatollah in place to this day.
Hmm. You, of course, were quite young when the Shah was deposed. I don't remember exactly how old were you, 8, 9, 10, something?
I was 8 years old, yeah.
8 years
exactly
old.
Exactly, 8.
And it seems that what your reaction was is actually probably the heart of the fear that many people in Iran had at that point, including probably some people who maybe weren't all that sad to see him go. But even among some of them, there was this really ominous fear rooted in the fact that no one knew what was coming next.
You're right, absolutely.
And one thinks especially about how frightening that might be for an 8-year-old.
Well, as an 8-year-old, really, people, you know, when you're a child, you don't really understand politics that well. And you're reacting basically to what the grown-ups around you are doing and reacting to. So while I knew that things were brewing and there were loud noises outside and I could hear my parents talking and in heated tones and my father having debates with his friends and so on, my reaction was really mostly based on theirs. For a child, you know, like the peace and calm and quiet of their surroundings is important for their development. But when you see your environment suddenly very agitated and angered, and that is really what you're mostly reacting to. So I was overhearing all of these conversations about the Shah left. What does this mean for us? What is going to happen next? And as you say, even those people who were out in the streets in support of the Shah leaving, I don't think maybe they were necessarily there welcoming the Ayatollah. They just wanted the Shah to leave. They didn't really know what would take its place. Yes, of course, some people were in support of the Ayatollah, and they still are of his policies, even though he's been dead a long time. But nobody really foresaw that the changes would be quite that way. They just wanted to have the Shah leave, have a cut of that Western ruling over our country, and maybe return a little bit to a more traditional country, but nothing quite like what ended up subsequently happening.
Explain a couple of the most dramatic ways in which you, as a youngster, saw things changing so dramatically in that country, the kinds of changes that would really powerfully resonate even with an 8 or 9 year old.
Absolutely. We immediately became a very rigid country, especially in the capital, Tehran, where we lived. What that meant was that there were a lot of young men, some of them under the age of 18, that were given guns by the new authorities to monitor and patrol the streets. And in the evenings, they would barricade some of the streets in some of the neighborhoods, and they would stop the cars on their way in and out of their homes. And a lot of times they would ask the driver to get out of their car to see if they had any alcohol. And so they would smell their breath. And if they had the misfortune of drinking alcohol, they would be beaten right there on the spot and taken to prison. So that happened actually one time when I was in the car with one of my uncles, and we were pulled aside, and a man who was young enough to be my uncle's son, you know, just started speaking to him in a very rude and disrespectful tone, which is also a big no-no in the Iranian culture. You always respect your elders and speak to them, you know, in a very respectable manner. And he pulled my uncle out of the car and made him, you know, breathe. Fortunately, my uncle hadn't consumed any alcohol that night. But just that moment of being 8 years old and realizing how my elders and my family were being treated by youngsters was very shocking. The other thing, too, was that in my own school, which was a French-Iranian school, which meant that there were many kids in attendance whose families were either working with the Shah, for the Shah, or connected to him. So as a result of the revolution, many of those families had to abruptly leave the country overnight to save their lives. And some of them who were not so fortunate, as you mentioned earlier, were executed. And so there was one young girl, Bianca, in my school who whose father was an officer for the Shah, and he was captured by the Islamic authorities and shot. And so hearing these stories as a child really just tells you, you know, you're not a child anymore. The real world can be very difficult and challenging, and really bad things can happen to you overnight, including to a classmate's father.
One of the most chilling things to read about is how the extremist form of Islam viewed women, and in particular, how they viewed girls. And which would lead to all sorts of practices being and regulations being very strictly imposed, even on quite young girls. Just say a word about this particular facet of all this, which is, I think, especially chilling.
So in Islam, a girl who turns 9 has to start covering herself up. Because in that view, she's ready to be married and as such an object of desire. So she has to cover her hair and cover her body. And that's what happened to us as fifth graders, was when we started having to wear a robe that covered everything. It had to be a loose robe, and we had to wear pants underneath it. We couldn't wear socks or tights or anything that would reveal our calves or even our ankles. And then a few short months after that, we started having to wear a scarf as well. And, you know, my reaction to that really was that my mom, being a French woman, was completely irate that her little girl, you know, I'm only 9 years old at the time, and I have to go out into the streets looking like that, all covered up as though there's something to be ashamed of. It was really just having a very difficult time with that, and for a long time would be very vocal about how ridiculous this attire was and how upset she was that I had to do this. And then she was very upset that she had to do it as well as a French woman and cover herself up in that way. And it was really just became, that's when the division between the inside life and the outside life happened in a very drastic way, because we still had to maintain pieces of ourselves that we liked and we wanted to be like, but we could only do that when we were indoors. And when we were outdoors, we immediately had to just sort of follow these rules. Otherwise, there were severe consequences, as I also highlighted in my book, which happened to me when I was 15 years old. I went out one day, and it was a very, very hot summer day. I was with my mom and my younger brother. And I made the mistake of rolling up my sleeves a little bit just to get a little bit of air circulation, and I unbuttoned the top button of my robe. So that means that there were a few inches of my arm showing and maybe like a couple of inches of my neck, which was a big no-no for the regime back then. And so I was spotted by a religious patrol, which was put in place by the government to monitor women and make sure that women were dressed properly and appropriately when they came out into the streets. And so this religious patrol, called the Zainab sisters, or I like to call them in my book the Black Crows, yes, they came after me. And one of them got out of the car and just threw me in without saying a word and peeled away. And so they took me to this makeshift prison that was in an apartment building in a residential neighborhood, and this building was under construction still. It wasn't quite finished yet. And it was a very strange place to take me to because really it was an apartment, not an actual official prison. But I always assumed that maybe this was a place they went to take their own personal breaks or something. I don't know. But they took me in there and they locked me up in a room for a few hours before letting me go. And back then I thought, well, I actually got lucky and got away with something that a lot of other women did not, because a lot of women would be taken straight to prison. Sometimes they were whipped. Oftentimes they were kept for multiple days without being able to see their families or speak to their families or anyone. But reflecting on it, you know, 20 or 30 years later when I was writing the book, it was really quite astonishing to think that something like that could happen to what's essentially a child.
Right, exactly.
So those were some of the things we had to contend with,
right.
Yes.
You explained that that at one point in this interrogation, this incredibly frightening interrogation, they are asking about your mother. You explained that she's from France, and then the woman you called the backseat crow said, that explains it. All Western women are whores, and you are the child of a whore. And of course, it is terrifying to be seen that way, and one just can scarcely imagine what that is like, especially when one is so young and not yet living with sort of an understanding of the context in which all of this is playing out. I also want you to say a word about your rather complicated relationship with, I believe it was your cousin, and I believe his name was Omid or Ahmed?
Yes, Omid.
Omid.
Yes.
And how this was somebody who really tormented you quite a lot, as is sometimes the case with family members. You did not like him very much. He made your life miserable quite a lot. And then something happens to him that really changes everything.
Yes, you're absolutely right. He was, you know, the annoying older cousin that many of us have. Like many of us have older brothers, I guess, that are annoying, but I did not have that. He was one of the young men who tried to escape Iran. In those days, a lot of families did not want their sons to go to the front to fight against Iraq. And so they were trying to find ways to help their sons escape from the war. And my family decided to hire the services of a smuggler who was taking these young boys who were under 18 at the time across the border. Oftentimes it was across the border from Iraq to Turkey, so the northwestern part of the country. And so they paid quite a large sum of money to the smuggler. And my cousin walked across the border, but just before being able to do that, they were caught by the border patrol. And a number of the boys who were in that group managed to escape, but my cousin was not one of them. And we always suspected that there had to have been a mole in their group. Someone had infiltrated their group and just tried to capture everyone at the border. And so Omid a month in solitary confinement in a room where he couldn't even stretch his legs fully. And he was interrogated every day, and he was beaten and smacked so often in the face that he couldn't hear out of one of his ears. And he wasn't given enough food. He was so thin when he came back home. He was barely recognizable. And I think having such a horrific ordeal happen to him really just kind of made him change in some things that were really good. You know, all of a sudden, I think he had to grow up. He had to stop being, I guess, a spoiled kid like that he was when he was, you know, before he was detained. And then after that, the shift was quite dramatic, and a lot of it was for the good. But just seeing my aunt and my uncle having to watch their son come home that way and what they endured was horrible. And what's more is that most of his friends managed to escape, not on the same day that he was, but at different times. So he was left without any of his closest friends, and everyone made it to Europe and eventually America except for him.
Hmm. It's very touching to read his story and also to see the change between the two of you in the midst of something so horrific. I do want to make sure that our listeners understand that although your book recounts many of these really difficult moments, many of these painful realities of what it was like to live in Iran at the time, the book is also, in a sense, leavened by many flashbacks to earlier times, to happier times. And I really appreciate that that's a part of this book, which is, in many respects, designed with young readers in mind, although I think anybody who cares about this kind of story should be reading this. I want, in particular, for you to just touch briefly on what you talk about in terms of your Muslim grandparents and the openness that they had to your mother and her traditions. You write at one point, "My grandparents, who were Muslims, had opened their hearts and minds to my mother's traditions. They were a true example of what their faith was really about." Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about here.
Thank you so much, first of all, for highlighting that and noting that about my book. I really appreciated that. Yes, I tried to, you know, give a sense of what Iran was like, not just what you already know. A lot of the things that I mentioned in the book about the revolution and the war, many readers will already have known about. But also, there are so many other things, like my own family, and they were the true, really, epitome of what a really religious person should be like and be open their hearts and mind to somebody new who's coming into their family. So my mother, who is French, really wanted to celebrate Christmas. And my grandparents in Iran had never celebrated Christmas. Maybe they barely even knew about it back then. But before my father actually even left Iran for good, my grandmother, Maman Bozorg, had pulled him aside and said, "I will support you if you want to marry a Western woman. I will not stand in the way of that. In fact, I think it would really suit you to marry someone from the West as opposed to an Iranian woman." So that just goes to show you how open she already was to the idea that that might happen. And then when my father did end up bringing his French wife home, everybody, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, cousins, extended family, just could not have been nicer. Everyone was constantly throwing parties for them in those first few years, doing everything that they could to make my mom feel at home because she obviously missed her family too. But my aunt Minu went to the Armenian district in Iran and bought the biggest Christmas tree she could find and brought it home and made ornaments out of ribbons for her. And she just organized the biggest Christmas party and had one of our relatives dress up as Santa Claus. It was really just so nice, and I really wanted to highlight that in my book because it wasn't all these sad, scary stories. There were also, in the midst of all this, really fun things happening. Like, even when we had bombings happening and we would know that the Red Siren would go off, well, my mom would be cooking a dish in the kitchen to bring down to the neighbors downstairs so we could all gather around and eat as the bombings may or may not have been happening that night. Or I was consumed with what I was going to wear that night because, you know, there was a cute neighbor boy coming down to the basement and I wanted to impress him. So there was still a lot of really nice things happening in life and ordinary things happening in life in the midst of all of the scary stuff as well.
Right, and that's what keeps everyone, of course, sane and keeps you tied together. And needless to say, you are able to safely escape. I mean, you otherwise would not have lived to write this book, but nevertheless, there's certainly a sense of suspense and very much right to the very end in terms of whether or not you are going to be allowed to leave. And we will leave it to our listeners to explore that in your book.
Yes.
The book, again, is titled Taking Cover, One Girl's Story of Growing Up During the Iranian Revolution. It is published by National Geographic. The author, Niyushi Homayunfar. Thank you so much for joining me today on the morning show, and thank you especially for writing this really important book. I hope many people will seek it out.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
The time is exactly 8:39. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, we have two guests, and one is very familiar to many of you, Carol Sabar. She has been on the morning show any number of occasions to talk about various issues related mostly to technology. Carol Sabar, you're going to have to remind me what your exalted title is at Carthage these days.
It's always evolving. Director of Library and Instructional Technology Services.
Very good. And we've had great conversations about a number of different things, including a really fun conversation right after a strange new thing called Facebook got created.
And we were social media, always a big topic.
Absolutely. And and many other interesting conversations over the years. Carol Sabar has with her today in the studios someone who is making her very first visit to the morning show, and it won't be her last. Mia Bennett, who is a Carthage grad and now on the staff at Carthage. She works for Carol Sabar in the Hedberg Library as the Green Technologies Assistant. And we're going to just touch briefly on what in the world that title means and probably have a conversation down the road in which we explore that a little further. Carol and Mia are here to talk about a new film series, or a series actually that began last year, but its new incarnation is about to resume this Thursday evening with a screening in the Campbell Student Union Auditorium Theater, a film called The Art of Rap. And it's going to be the first of four films in a series called This is America, American Perspectives on the United States. And sounds like a really interesting undertaking, and I'm excited that we can talk about it. Carol Sabar, Mia Bennett, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're excited to be here.
Good to have you here. So, Carol, let's talk for a moment about this notion of a green technologies assistant. You were telling me before we went on the air that Mia is not the first, that this is something you've had as part of your staff for a number of years now. Explain to our listeners what sort of gave you the idea that it was important to have such a person on the staff.
Sure. And let me clarify, too, that the Green Technology Assistant is essentially a student staff person. So they've always been a Carthage student. They've always been women so far. I think that Mia is our fifth person that we had. So, yes, a number of years ago, it struck me that there were things that all institutions, but certainly Library and Information Services at Carthage, could do a little bit better related to technology and green, so sustainability. So the things that we've always looked at are, what are things that we could do unilaterally, so just decide, you know, in the library at Carthage, that we can turn off the computers at the end of the day and not leave them running, or that we could recycle things in a specific way ourselves. And then there are things that you need to convince other people to do, right? Like turn off their gizmos when they're not using them, or recycle appropriately, and so on. So I personally didn't have time to work on things like that. So I hired a student assistant, and every year since then I've had one or two. We actually have two right now. So Ellie Haviland is my other green technology assistant, and do things like promote recycling and just recycled a giant batch ton of toner cartridges and things that had collected over time. So it could be any number of things. We do maintain a Facebook page, so if folks out there want to look at Carthage Going Green, Carthage Green is what they would look for on Facebook, and then like our page, and they can see tips and things like that periodically. So that's where we are.
Excellent. So Carthage shifts from red to green in this particular instance. That's great. So Mia Bennett, tell our listeners what is most important for them to know about you.
Most important to know about me are my personal passions, because I try and implement them through my daily work and through my life. So personally, I'm very invested in diversity, equity, inclusion, and I definitely mentioned that to Carol when we first met, and we were talking about ways that we could implement that through our messaging through sustainability. And one thing about sustainability and social justice is they're kind of cyclical, and they kind of build off of each other. So when I picked up this job, I was looking for ways to implement, you know, marketing techniques on campus to get the student population more involved in green sustainability, you know, actions and behaviors, being more frugal with, you know, energy usage and things like that. But I've additionally picked up the project, the film series that you mentioned, because it is part of my personal passions. And like I said, I try and do things that I'm passionate about within my work and my life.
Excellent. Where are you from originally?
That's such an interesting question, because there's an interesting backstory. My dad was in the Navy, so we traveled a lot when I was younger. But I was raised in Willis, Texas, which is about 45 minutes north of Houston, and then moved up here during high school for the last few years to live in Lake Villa, Illinois.
Ah.
Yep, and so I'm not too far, but my extended family is pretty far away.
Right. So what drew you to Carthage? What attracted you to Carthage?
I'll tell you, track and field, honestly. After high school, I didn't really have much of a direction of where I wanted to go. But I do know that sports really impacted a lot of the decisions that I made afterwards. And Carthage was one of the very few schools that reached out to me and said, you know, we want you to be on our track team. We want you to throw for us. I wasn't the most talented athlete either, so my options weren't, you know, very extended, but Carthage reached out, and I really liked the culture. I really liked the small class sizes because I am from a small town, and just the campus, obviously. Everyone who goes to Carthage loves the lake, so the culmination of all those factors really made me decide for sure that Carthage is somewhere I'd want to spend a long period of time.
Right, and studying what?
I studied psychology in my undergrad, so I was in occupational therapy concentration. Super focused on that up until my junior year. I did my OT hours, and I was like, this is not for me. Mm. And, you know, I'm okay with admitting that because, you know, not everybody knows what they want early on in life.
Sure.
So during that last senior year that I had, I was a little bit lost and decided to apply for this Master's of Business Design because I know that business will really take you far in life. Everybody needs business skills, and I want to be a leader in my own career. And business is a perfect, you know, pathway for that. So here I am now.
Excellent. So you're still in that master's program.
Yes, exactly.
Very good. Carol Sabar, tell us a little bit of background on this film series, which in this current incarnation now is called This Is America. But tell us kind of about the genesis of it.
Sure. So shout out to one of our wonderful librarians at Carthage, Danelle Orange. She's our archivist and so much more. She's just has so many talents, it's kind of hard to catalog them all. So Carthage began almost exactly 2 years ago now, an equity and inclusion program for, I think there are approximately 20 faculty and staff that go through a year-long program. They take this brutal test on sort of what is your, you know, how culturally, I don't know, understanding are you or whatever. And everybody comes out of that kind of going, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, I have so much to learn. And so
probably in many cases, people who have thought of themselves as fairly evolved in that respect and then realize, oh dear.
Exactly. So Danelle did that the first year that it was available. I did it the second year. So I can attest to the fact that it is, I've been thinking about this a lot because we're really at the last week or so of that program. And it really, it starts off, you think, you know, you take this test and it feels like a test and it feels like an evolution of your mind. And I think in some ways, it's not even really just an evolution of your heart. It's really an evolution of your soul. It's really about your ability to empathize and see things so differently. So the fact, for example, you know, I'm a white person, coming to grips with what my white privilege means and how that shapes the way that I think. And the fact that, for example, the most poignant example I can think of is my children are actually probably older than me. They're 29 and 30. And I never had to teach them that, you know, if you get pulled over by a policeman, make sure you keep your hands up here and don't say this and don't do that. I'm pretty sure that when Mia has her children someday, she will have to educate her children. Hopefully, maybe not by then. But,
right.
But I mean, that's a thing that people need to do. And it hurts me when I think about people having to be afraid. You know, I think of my own irrational fears potentially about driving through a poor neighborhood and locking my doors and trying to do it without anybody noticing that I'm locking my doors because I don't want them to feel bad. Mm-hmm. But yet, why do I do that? And yet, minority people can drive through a white neighborhood and have exactly that same feeling and probably with a lot more reason for having that feeling because, you know, a lot more things happen like that than what I'm afraid of. So anyway, back to they did this cohort of equity and inclusion. Danelle was in the first one. And as a part of each person that goes through equity and inclusion is encouraged to sort of find ways not only to come to grips with things themselves, but also to sort of reach out and help educate others. So one of the things that Danelle did was put together this film series and chose a variety of different films, some of them focused on the political scene in Chicago, for example. There was one on Cabrini Green. Mm. There was one on the election of Harold Washington, among other things. And so so that was sort of the genesis of all of this, was Donnell wanting to put together something that would have some impact for some other people. And there are a lot of amazing films out there that will either make you cry, make you an activist, open your eyes, make you aware of historically horrible things that have happened that you had no idea that the Truckee method, for example, was one where they specifically in California, a town came up with a way to try to drive out all the Chinese immigrants that were there. And they methodically figured out how to make the Chinese people leave. It's just, it was heartbreaking to watch. I mean, it was just terrible. So,
and it's these kind of stories that are part of our history, and they're woven into the fabric of who we are, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so these films are being chosen to try to kind of awaken us,
of
to
course.
Open our eyes and broaden our perspectives in some really important ways. So Mia Bennett, you have taken over kind of supervision of this film series, and this Thursday evening will be the first of four films that are going to be screened. And this is a film called The Art of Rap.
Yeah.
And so first of all, tell us about it and why you chose it, why you think this is a film that belongs in this series.
So The Art of Rap, what it does, it kind of tells the story of the hip-hop movement in America and how it's kind of transformed over time and the influence it's had over pop culture globally. And I chose this because it's one of America's original art forms. Everyone thinks of jazz, you know, off the bat, but rap is another art form that really originated here in America, in the ghetto and among the Black community. And I wanted to kind of highlight it, one, because it is Black History Month, and we should talk about, you know, the celebrations and passions of Black people just as much as we've overcome adversity. And the art of rap really tells the story of one of the original art forms coming from that culture. And I think it's something that people should really take the time to appreciate.
So tell us more about what we actually see in the film, and also tell us about the person who's primarily behind it.
Right. So the director of the film is the rapper Ice-T. And he really utilizes his network within this film. He talks to a lot of the original rappers that are notable for their original, you know, groundbreaking influences in the rap culture. So we hear things from, you know, Grandmaster Flash and Grandmaster Caz and, you know, the original rap songs and people who contribute to the art form. But then he kind of moves through history and talks to 80s rappers, 90s rappers, MC Light. He has interviews with Nas, who is very popular, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, Kanye West, Dougie Fresh, all these influential rap artists, but they're not just talking about the music, they're talking about it as an art form and, you know, the impact that it has on people who are listening to it.
Interesting. What is your sense of who this film is primarily for? I mean, is it primarily for white people like me who barely understand what rap is? Or is it more designed for somebody who already likes it but just wants to know a little more about it, or is it for just about anybody?
Yeah, this movie, Ice-T really directed it so that anybody, who, regardless of their background, if they have an interest in rap culture or hip-hop culture, they can watch this film and gain a new appreciation for it. It highlights some of the major moments in rap history, and so it kind of introduces you to the culture, but it's really formulated for everybody.
What is your hope for somebody seeing this film? I mean, what kind of impact do you think it could potentially have for people who go to see it? I mean, in light of the passions that you kind of outlined before, what are important, and what Carol described in terms of why you are doing this film series, how do you see this film serving some of those purposes?
The fact that it connects to the roots of pop culture in the United States, like I said before, pop culture in the U.S. really has a lot of roots in hip-hop, with the way people dress, the way people talk, and the stylization of music that you hear on the radio these days. So I'm hoping people that come in to see this film really connect to that and see the origins of how, you know, millennial and my generation's culture has formulated around this art form.
So this screening is this Thursday evening, 7:30, in the movie theater in the Campbell Student Union Auditorium. And Again, it's called The Art of Rap, and it's the first of four films that are going to be screened as part of this series that is titled This is America, American Perspectives on the United States. I know that a couple of the films are still under discussion, but I think you're pretty sure about what your fourth film is going to be in May. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes. So we have a really big showing in May scheduled for the film Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And the director reached out to us asking to show this film as an opportunity to educate our students. And we really jumped on that opportunity because it is the longest running non-Hollywood film in America in over, I want to say, I think in the entire history of film, really. Yeah. It's non-Hollywood. It was produced in 18 days or filmed in 18 days, and it tells the story of, you know, Native American experiences. So not to give too much away from the film, I haven't seen it myself because it is still running in theaters. Mm. But the story tells about a white writer who travels to Lakota country and speaks to, or I guess listens to, the story of a few Native Americans and their story. And there's not too much specifics out there about the movie because it's still in theaters and there's not much to really put out there. But it's one of the most authentic films so far, based off reviews that really tell of an authentic Native American experience. And that's something that's really important, being an American, understanding, you know, the indigenous roots and an authentic perspective of that.
Right. Carol, you were saying that the screening of this is going to coincide with a very important anniversary.
Yes, exactly. Mia, you could actually probably talk better a little bit to the date that you chose to screen this and why that's a significant date.
I chose May 9th of this year because it's actually going to represent the 50th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Massacre and riots that happened up in North Dakota 50 years ago.
Wow. So that will be an important anniversary to remember in a lot of different ways, and one of them is to see this highly regarded film, which will be the culmination of this film series. And I suspect, Carol, that you're already thinking about this going on from here. I mean, it's a really exciting perspective, and the prospect of sharing even more films with the community, I should think, is exciting.
I was thinking about this a little bit this morning as I was driving in, Greg, that media is such a powerful thing. I mean, some of the, you know, the probably one of the reasons why I lock my doors when I drive through a poor neighborhood or whatever is based on a lot of movies that I've seen, right? You know, everybody's seen Death Wish and, you know, all these things that happen. So I think that in the same way that we've picked up sometimes some really bad perceptions and some misperceptions of people and cultures and so forth based on our experience with the media and movies and advertisements and so forth, I think that media is a very powerful thing on the other end as an agent for change for good as well. So rather than just having somebody tell you or certainly reading a story in the news or whatever, being able to see things dramatized or actually seeing the real people as we do in both of these films, right? So, I mean, these are firsthand perspectives. This is people, you listening to people talk about their own experiences. And, you know, mentally, hopefully nobody can get away with not comparing their own American experience with what they're seeing on the screen and what they're hearing.
And putting themselves in someone else's shoes.
Right.
I'm reminded of the Carthage professor Dudley Riggle. He loved to talk about how the word understanding in one respect means very literally what it says, standing under somebody in their shoes, right where they are, right where they live. And it sounds like these films can do that. We want to remind our listeners that the first of these four films in this series, This is America, is going to be screened this Thursday night in the Campbell Student Union Auditorium, called The Art of Rap, a film created by Ice-T. And for anybody intrigued with rap and hip-hop and where all that came from and the influence it has on our overall culture, this is a film for you to seek out. And Mia Bennett is overseeing this film series as a Green Technologies assistant at Carthage, and Carol Sabar with us as well. Thank you both for this conversation. We look forward to having you back very soon to talk more about matters related to green living and sustainability. But in the meantime, thank you for this conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
It's exactly 8:59 here on WGTD. Tomorrow I'll speak with Nancy Matthews and Dan Joyce from the Kenosha Public Museum about a program called From Curiosity to Science. On Wednesday, the author of a very provocative book called Raising White Kids, in which this guest, who is a professor at Drake University and is white, talks about the challenge she feels and other white parents feel in raising white children in an age in which there is still so much injustice against people of other races. On Thursday, Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College. On Friday, we preview the Racine Theater Guild's current production of Wait Until Dark. And we also want to preview for you on Friday, Sunday afternoon's recital with the final